Call the meeting to order. This is a State Government Finance Committee meeting for Wednesday, February 1st. Happy February, everybody. The first item on our agenda is the approval of the minutes from yesterday. Would someone move those minutes?
I'll move those minutes.
Moved by Stensrud, Representative Stensrud. Any additions or corrections? If not, all in favor of the minutes, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved. We have several reports that are being brought to us today by the State Auditor, and we welcome State Auditor Rebecca Otto. Welcome to the committee. And you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. And it is morning. I'm Rebecca Otto, the State Auditor, and I am very pleased to bring before you today the Collaborative Governance Council report from 2011. And this was a culmination of work by a group that were appointed due to legislation that was created in 2010. They created this council. We have members from the League of Minnesota Cities, Association of Minnesota Counties, Minnesota Association of Townships, MSBA, School Board Association, we have the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and we have the three major unions, SEIU, AFSCME, and Education Minnesota. And that was the makeup that the lawmakers wanted. It was a bipartisan bill, and the governor signed it, Governor Pawlenty. This group did a lot of work. We were kind of charged with reviewing statutes, state rules, and things that might be getting in the way of collaboration and cooperation of local governments. After reviewing statutes, we didn't find many issues in terms of things getting in the way. Sometimes there's perceived issues, so we have recommendations at the back. But what I want to go through is kind of our process briefly. We were charged with making recommendations to the governor and to the legislature to increase collaboration in government. All of our meetings were open to the public. All meeting materials and meeting dates were posted on the Office of the State Auditor website. And we do get good traffic there. We watch that, and folks are keeping an eye. We have our meeting minutes and agendas and any handouts. For this report, we had met 9 times, 2 hours apiece. We had very productive meetings. We also had folks coming from the public. We had small business owners, interested citizens. We had lobbyists, and we had other chamber representatives, local chambers. After reviewing, looking for impediments, we looked for impediments in state statute or state rules. We reviewed some great collaborations within local government, things that had gone really well. And we focused in on some areas important to collaboration. The group wanted to make sure that if we made any recommendations to you or recommended any changes, that we always made sure that service delivery would be enhanced, not diminished, so you focus on excellent service delivery, and that you look for redundancy in efforts or cost. So you want to make sure if someone else is doing this, why are two entities in government doing it? So we look for redundancy. We wanted to make sure that oversight was also always considered and accountability if we created something different or new. Recognizing the state had a big deficit, we wanted to work to make the environment more flexible for local governments to deal with potential cuts. It's not a surprise the group wanted to look at technology. And we have a member from Roseau County, Greater Minnesota, but all the members on the council recognize that if local governments don't have access to high-speed broadband internet, and even the businesses in their communities, it can be create not a level playing field. So rather than us reinventing the wheel, we had Rick King, who had been the chair of the Minnesota High-Speed Broadband Task Force, and he talked about the report that we put together. There were lots of folks that got together to look at what do we need to do in the state of Minnesota to make sure we have high-speed broadband around the state. And the council, essentially, after reviewing all of that, strongly support that report and the timeline that was that laid out within the report to try to get that access for all around the state. We were asked in statute to review to see if we should be drafting templates for joint power agreements or joint power entity type paperwork. And after looking at it, there's really good stuff out there already. There's templates available. But the one thing that these local governments, that sometimes they think it's a financial impediment to hire an attorney, but even if you have a template for these agreements, you have to have an attorney look at it to make sure you get it right in the first place, depending on what you're doing with other entities. So hiring an attorney can be a financial impediment for some of our entities. We also looked at joint purchasing agreements or cooperative purchasing ventures. We found that there's a lot of them out there. You know, there's a state contract, there is national groups that have, you know, cooperative purchasing type ventures for local governments. And we said, well, let's find out if there's a best. Can we recommend a best for local governments to use, whether it's buying a school bus, a police car, whatever the purchase may be. And what we found was there is not a best answer, but it's important that local governments know their options. Let's see here. We also reviewed great successes in collaboration and impediments. And basically what we found was through conversations and sharing of stories and folks coming in and testifying, the biggest impediments to collaboration are mistrust between entities and financial struggles, who's going to pay if they try to do something different. And then sometimes there's power struggles, who's going to have control. And those all can derail a collaborative effort and or a cooperative effort. We found that one of the really important elements you need to be successful with any cooperation or collaboration is you have to communicate regularly and often, and that really relationships are the very key to good, strong working relationships are key to successful collaborations. We also wanted to note that collaboration and or cooperation does not always reduce costs. It does not always enhance service delivery. There are some unfortunate stories out there, and so it's not always a good thing, and it doesn't always reduce costs. Sometimes it does over the long term, but it's not always a cost reducer. But if you enhance your service and maybe cut down on some of your long-term costs in terms of purchasing equipment and things, you might save there. After we had our discussions, the council wanted my office to do a report, a best practices review on collaboration in government. And so we are currently working on that. I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a moment. Our recommendations to the legislature and governor are that the legislature not impose service delivery regions or consolidate local units of government, that you allow that to happen. I'll use the term organically. Every part of our state is a little bit different. The needs are different. Sometimes the services they deliver are different. When you're in a very rural area where there's not a lot of population density, the needs there and how they do things can be very different than, you know, some like Anoka County where everybody's really close. You have, you know, high population density. We further recommend that the legislature allow local government leaders to find ways to collaborate with others based on their local needs with a focus on efficiency and excellent service delivery. We voted unanimously to strongly support the Minnesota Ultra High Speed Broadband Task Force reports that had recommendations to you all and the governor, including the timeline, which I mentioned. There was one policy issue that we brought to you, we're hoping that you might review, and I know it'll be in a specific committee. Through our discussions, we recognize that the Minnesota Open Meeting Law, as it now stands, does not provide clarity as to a government's ability to meet beyond its jurisdictional boundaries. Does that make sense? So if they want to go to another community to talk to a bunch of communities about something, and there's, you know, more than a certain number of council members, are they going to run into trouble? And are there ways to deal with that while still keeping that transparency and openness? They think it's important to have that clarified, and so we ask that the legislature review the law and relative case law to foster cooperation and efficient use of resources. So that could be a slight impediment. So our office is going to be releasing pretty quickly here, best practices review. It's going to be on building relationships. And what we found with some of our local governments was we heard about one county that said, let's do this, and they pulled all the cities in, and they all sat down, and they kind of looked at each other for about an hour because they weren't sure what to do. And that might sound funny, but they weren't used to doing business that way. And so we have some local governments and nonprofits and private sector folks that are working together, doing great work. If they've been doing it for a long time, studies show they tend to be successful at continuing to do it. The ones that haven't gotten started sometimes don't know where to get started, and sometimes they'll have issues like old jurisdictional battles, you know. Sometimes your hockey team beat my hockey team, and we don't like you guys at all. You know, it's that whole rivalry thing, and it's real. It's really real. So we have to help people who have those issues in these entities to overcome that. So this first review is on building relationships in local governments with all your community partners. The second one is going to be on if you get into a cooperative or collaborative effort, how to do it right, whether it be formal or informal. The final review is going to be on once you get into some sort of effort, you need to monitor and measure the results. Is each entity getting out of it what they'd hoped and agreed upon? Is it costing more? Is it costing less? Does it need to be adjusted? So we're going to try to put together very easy-to-use, user-friendly reports that will help our local officials. Good morning. So are there any questions on those two items, Mr. Chair?
Any questions? Representative Kahn.
Yes. I'm interested in the issue of the high-speed broadband task force. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues that I'm interested in is, has this been rendered obsolete at all by the development of things like super Wi-Fi and stuff like that? I was traveling in parts of, like, rural Indonesia 20 years ago, and they were using cell phones and Wi-Fi to an extent that I don't even think we're using it now. So that's the question. But is this place, is this high-speed broadband group, is there some reason why it couldn't be replaced by a network of cell towers and Wi-Fi?
Auditor Otto?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, I didn't serve on that task force. I don't believe that they're meeting anymore. I believe there's, I believe it's a commission that's been set up now that's kind of tracking where our high-speed broadband internet is.
And no one asked that in the whole courts of coming out with these recommendations?
What we did, Mr. Chair.
Adorado.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. Mr. King came and presented kind of the highlights of the report, told us about their process, who was involved, the work that they did, and what they've recommended to the legislature. I believe the legislature put into statute in terms of the states making a commitment to try to get this done by a certain date. I was not part of those discussions, so I'm not sure. I'm sorry.
Representative Kahn?
That's all. I mean, I'm just throwing that question out. I don't know if there's anyone here who can answer it or if it's our job to look into it.
There's somebody.
Oh.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Otto, I've heard, and I'm reading, I guess, that you sent a survey out to the counties regarding the services delivered from your office. Can you enlighten us as far as who put that survey together? What, did you use a specific survey company? Was that questions that were generated from your office relative to specific issues within your office, or can you enlighten us?
Auditor Otto?
Mr. Chair, I was going to finish up this part, and I was going to present the county survey. Is that acceptable, or do you want to move on?
That's a different. That's fine. I can wait until that time. And
sure.
As an addition to that, though, could you make a note to yourself, and then I'll have to ask the question again. Could you send a copy of that survey to all of us on the committee?
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Auditor Otto, looking at the recommendations, I certainly understand how this group would not want the legislature to mandate service delivery regions or mandate a consolidation or whatever. And in the next recommendation that you want to the legislature to allow government leaders to find ways to collaborate, I don't see anything about incentives or encouragement or whatever.
Yes.
Is that something this group is not interested in?
Mr. Chair? Oh, they're very interested. You know, when we met last year, you all had a massive deficit to deal with, and it was a very difficult time. We knew there were deficits, and so the group decided not to ask for money because we didn't think that that would go over very well. It was a realistic, I think it was realistic for the situation. I think they would be interested. I think I can speak for them. This year, we're meeting again. We don't have a report to issue at this time. I can give you an update on what we're working on. There's an interest in financial incentives because I've heard it, and I've gotten calls in my office from local officials saying, are there any programs out there to help us overcome the hump? We're trying to do something different. We need a little bit of help. And I'm not aware of programs right now for them, short of perhaps foundations. We're also talking about and looking at, we're working on this for another meeting, is trying to have facilitators available for folks when they're trying to meet, and they can have someone help them run a very productive meeting and keep people on track. And I'm trying to find out if it really needs resources or not. I guess there's a whole network out there that we might be able to tap into, the locals can. So we're doing further research on that. I know they would never turn down an incentive. Some are interested in that. Probably even our smaller ones are interested because they have such limited staff. So I would imagine for our next report we'll have something there for you all. So.
Well, not all incentives would need to be financial in nature. I mean, there are other incentives that could be offered. As they consider that, I hope that they also consider maybe incentives or encouragement or whatever based on outcomes. Mm-hmm. That I think what we're interested in is if units of government working together collaboratively produces positive results, positive outcomes, mm-hmm. that ought to be part of the discussion, it seems to me. So I wish you'd pass that on. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick question to make sure I'm kind of understanding the background and what went into all of this. Auditor, could you just explain the kind of the timing and when the first meetings were, how many meetings there were, and over what kind of a period of time produced this report?
Mm-hmm. Auditor Otto?
Yep, Representative Downey, in the introduction section of the report, so if you go to the right after the cover, all of our meetings were open to the public, all meeting material notices were posted on the Office of State Auditor website. We held 9 meetings, which were 2 hours in length apiece. There was strong attendance of members from the public at the meetings. It has a list of who came. And there's no staff, there's no salary, there's no per diem, so it was on people's own dime. And we have a commissioner coming from Roseau County, which is a bit of a haul, but he's been really great about coming. So that's, I guess that's how it went. They're all kind of volunteers from these different groups, and they're there representing the interests of, you know, their members, whether it be the league or AMC. Does that help, Mr. Representative Downey?
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Auditor Otto. I was invited and went to a meeting in Eagan, and there must have been, I don't know, over 100 local officials and school board members and the like, and some state legislators, and we were facilitated through a kind of a multi-hour effort at identifying a number of specific and concrete opportunities for shared services and collaboration and the like. Was the meeting that I attended one of the ones that you're referring, or was the thing that I attended something different?
Auditor Otto?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, if it's one of the ones they held around the state, that was, I shouldn't say redundant, but it was an effort that was somewhat similar to ours, but a little bit different, because I think that one engaged local leaders. I believe there were lawmakers there like yourself, and I think the foundations helped kind of fund a trip around the state. And so it was checking in and having that conversation and looking for impediments as well. And usually they center around relationship issues. It's trust and or mistrust that can impact whether these things happen. Because there's a lot of great ideas out there, certainly, and there's long lists of things that have been done. But it's, you know, you have to look at the particular people involved, the part of the state, and helping them have the tools to do the things that they would like to do. And that's why we're doing this series on best practices, trying to help them understand how it works and what they need to do.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I don't mean to be overly critical. Maybe we're just very much on the front end of this thing. But this report and, frankly, some of the other ones that we've seen here in the last week or so in front of this committee reporting on the status of the initiatives that we prescribed in law are really, I'm sorry, I'll just say inadequate. I'm looking at the recommendations here, and I mean, I think we could have written these recommendations. They're probably, frankly, practically written into the law that asked this group to meet. And I'm looking back at what the recommendations we were expecting to get back were: reviewing laws and rules that slow collaboration efforts, how to use technology to connect entities and share information, modernizing financial transactions and facilitating credit and debit card transactions, electronic funds transfers, etc., creating model forms for joint power agreements. And all we have here is kind of a list of the barriers, which I think every single one of us knew going into this. So I don't know what these groups are doing, but if the intent is for those groups to actually produce something meaningful and actionable, I'd say they're failing miserably. So far, I mean, every report we've gotten back is just saying, well, we're starting to think about it.
Arado?
Mr. Chair, what I'd like to clarify for Representative Downey, collaboration's been going on for a long time in the state. This is not a new concept. This is nothing that's really different. Our local governments have been very creative, and we have some courageous leaders out there that have said, let's try to do something different. Ramsey County has a special group that has been meeting for years and years and years and years, and all the cities come, and they figure out where they can collaborate, share services, share resources, and it's a very functional group. So this isn't new or different. Some of the issues you listed on in statute were not issues. The group got together, and some of the perceived issues were really not issues. And so what we did was to try to dig in, and because the legislature was interested in, are there great impediments out there? Some folks thought there were impediments, but it turns out the law really didn't read as though they thought. So there is interest. Hearings are being held around the state, like one of the ones you went to. Some entities are better at doing this than others. The legislature created this group, and the legislature can get rid of the group. But I believe that our report's actually going to be cited in a national publication. So I think somebody saw some value in the work that the group did. So, and we're continuing to look at further issues this year to, again, try to help promote local governments and assist them in figuring out how to do things differently. But this won't be the panacea, the $5 billion solution. It doesn't save a lot of money over time, because you're focusing on enhancing service delivery, and you can reduce costs hopefully as well, but the reductions aren't always great.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. You said this is nothing new, and I guess I agree. I don't think we're getting any value add from this activity, and I'm not sure what it takes to shut it down or if we need to shut it down, but to have it rise to the level of a formalized report and somehow thinking that it's actually going to contribute to us making some meaningful changes going forward. I don't see that happening, and I'm not sure where the rest of the country is if this is getting national recognition, because just identifying that there's mistrust between local units of government and we have, you know, barriers and state laws that are an impediment to this, that's nothing new.
Representative Kahn.
Well, I hate to be in the position of supporting my sometimes adversary, Representative Downey, against my good friend, State Auditor Otto, but I just want to second everything he said. I think he's right on, and I think this is what, when we look at these recommendations, it's kind of a waste of our time. Not to mention the time of everyone who worked on them for this long period of time.
A further question on this report? Yes.
I just wondered if, Mr. Chair, if
please
you'd like to have
my
name is Ann Higgins from the League of Minnesota Cities, and you raised a question just before the last discussion about the broadband task force and the information that is, whether it's available, whether there's a study that could be done of the Wi-Fi infrastructure that Representative Kahn mentioned. There is a new task force. It began meeting after the state shutdown. It was delayed by that. It started meeting in November. There are interests on the part of industry to present some ideas about wireless technology. I've been monitoring the meetings, and I would be happy to relay your interest in that issue. I think it does have potential. I'm not a technology expert. I can't speak to its capabilities to create some opportunity that may overcome some of the other questions that might need to be dealt with at the local level for collaborative efforts. I do know, for instance, too, though, that the Fire Chiefs Association has been working on some efforts over a couple of years, and they've been making some very good progress in parts of the state, but not in others. So there is a great variety of response to these kinds of things on the part of local officials. But we had a presentation about that for cities 2 years ago at one of our conferences, and I know they're continuing to work on that.
Thank you, Ms. Higgins. Auditor Otter, do you want to move on to your next report?
I'm happy to do that, Mr. Chair. And I just have a clarifying question. It's difficult for me to do this, Council, although I was willing to put time and energy into it, to have the conversations, to be a resource for other local officials who needed help. This isn't my brainchild. This was Representative McFarland and Representative Swales. And they, I think, had good intentions working on this bill. And I know Representative McFarland is still engaged in trying to make good things happen around the state, which I think is commendable. And so if the, you know, I know you'd have to pass official legislation to disband the council, but it was created by you all. It can be disbanded. This was not my council. This was the legislature's. And so I was willing to chair the effort and put my time in. And if it's something that you don't think is valuable, we don't have to meet anymore because I have other things to do. So it's really, I guess I don't know if I'm getting direction from you officially.
Well, we're not here to settle that today. Okay. That question has been raised, and that'll have to be a question for further consideration down the road here.
Okay.
So you can proceed to the next report.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think finally my last piece is that we, the Office of State Auditor, conducted a survey of the counties that we currently audit, and so hopefully you have that in front of you. It was completed on January 11th, meaning done and wrapped up. We surveyed the counties. The survey was open from December 8th to December 23rd, so it was a little over 2 weeks. They got reminders, and we had a 76 response rate, which is actually very, very good. We conduct other surveys of local governments, and so we thought that was pretty good, especially with busy schedules. And we had a county say, is this mandated, do we have to? And we said, well, you don't have to, but we'd like you to. So anyway, but we were happy with the response rate. And so here are some of the results. What the survey focused on was regarding their annual audit for the year end of December 31, 2010. The survey focused on timeliness and cost of the annual audits performed by the OSA. Of the 59 counties that we currently audit, 76% completed. They were on the timeliness issue. They were asked about the timeliness of their 2010 audit performed by the Office of State Auditor. Of the 45 counties responding, 10 counties, or 22%, participated in the GFOA Certificate of Excellence in Financial Reporting Program. That program requires an audit deadline of June 30. All 10 participating counties, or 100%, reported that their audits were completed on time. The remaining 35 counties were not GFOA audits, and so their deadline is September 30. Of these 35 counties, 33, or 94%, reported their audits were completed on time, and two counties, or 6%, reported their audits were not issued, were issued after the September 30 deadline. These two counties were asked the reasons why their audits were late. Both counties identified a cause for the late audit as other personnel issue, not among those listed in the survey choices. One of the counties also identified new personnel completing audit prep work and staff unfamiliar with governmental financial reporting requirements as additional reasons for the audit being issued after the deadline. Counties were asked to prepare, they are asked annually to prepare an audit preparation checklist prior to the start of the audit. And what the checklist is it's used by counties to prepare for the audit. It has a list of all the tasks they need to complete before we can begin the work. And the checklist allows for efficient use of time by both the county and the OSA staff. Of the 45 counties responding to the survey, 93% reported completing an audit prep checklist, which is very good. Of those respondents, 36 counties, or 86%, reported that county personnel adhered to their committed completion dates, allowing the OSA to proceed with the audit of the county's financial statements according to the schedule, which is very good. The next topic was cost of the audit. The survey asked if the county's cost for the December 31, 2010 audit increased or decreased from the prior year. 56%, or 25 counties, reported their costs had decreased. 44%, or 20 counties, reported their costs had increased. Counties were then asked to identify reasons for the increase or decrease in their costs. The 25 counties who reported a decrease in costs identified the following reasons for the decrease. So 72% of the respondents said that they had a decrease in their audit cost because the county completed and adhered to the audit preparation checklist. So really, it's kind of a best practices for these entities. The next biggest response, 36% of the respondents said the county had internal control policies and procedures documented for the 2010 audit. Then 28% said the county provided additional training to assist county staff in preparing financial statements for the audit. 28% also said the number of internal control or compliance findings decreased from 9 to 10. 16% said the county hired a consultant to help prepare for the audit. 16% said the county received less federal funding in 2010. 12% said the number of major federal programs decreased from 9 to 10. All these things can impact the cost of an audit. And then 12% said the 2009 audit findings included material misstatements, audit adjustments, and the finding was resolved in 2010, which means the county did a good job. And finally, the 8% said the county had major construction, a capital project, or bond issue in 9, but not in 10. So that can also reduce the work that's required during the audit. For the entities, the 20 counties who have reported an increase in their audit costs, 50% said the reason was the county received American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds, which required more work on their part and required more work on the auditor's part. 45% said the county received new or additional federal funds, which can increase the work and the audit work. 45% said the county had internal control or compliance findings in the 2010 audit, which normally will require more work from the auditors. 35% said implementation of new accounting standards has created more work for county staff in preparing for the annual audit. 20% said the county did not conduct a risk assessment of its internal controls. 20% said the county did not complete the financial statement preparation work. 15% said the number of major federal programs audited increased, which requires additional auditing. The county had major construction, a capital project, or bond issue in 2010. That was 15%. 10% said the county's internal control policies and procedures were not documented in writing. 10% said the county had material misstatements identified by auditors during the 2010 audit, which requires more work. And finally, 10% said there were delays in the county completing its financial statement preparation work. Okay. We found the responses really interesting and very informative. The final question on the survey asked whether the county would like the Office of the State Auditor staff to follow up on how to improve the timeliness of an audit and or how to reduce or control audit costs. Of the 45 counties responding to the survey, 56% or 25 counties answered yes. The remaining respondents answered no, indicating they were not interested in learning how to improve the timeliness of their audit and or how to reduce or control audit costs. And I can tell you, my staff works with all counties who voice concerns or have issues, but my staff has been doing follow-up with those counties and giving them the tools they need to try to, again, work to control their costs or decrease them. And finally, the quality of the audit. There's a section in the summary survey that states that professional audit standards require that an audit organization have quality control procedures in place to ensure that services are competently delivered and adequately supervised. Both the American Institute of Certified Public Accountant Standards and the Government Accounting Standards require auditors to develop and maintain an effective system of quality control. To make sure those quality control procedures are working, auditors engaged in the practice of public accounting in the U.S. are required to be enrolled in an approved practice monitoring program. Also, the Minnesota State Board of Accountancy requires that accounting firms undergo a peer review once every 3 years as part of its licensing process. The goal of practice monitoring is to promote quality in the accounting and auditing services provided by the auditors. The Office of the State Auditor complies with these standards by obtaining an external peer review every 3 years. The OSA's most recent external peer review did not include any findings and indicated that the OSA's quality control policies and procedures were in place, operated effectively, and met the auditing standards. And you can view a complete copy of our peer review on our website. It's not a really long document, but we do have it up, and we provide it to our audit clients before we conduct an audit. And that's the survey, Mr. Chair.
Auditor Otto, it's impossible to determine the adequacy of the survey until we see it. Mm-hmm. And I hope that you will supply a copy of the survey to us so that we have more information so we can evaluate whether or not the survey was an adequate collection of opinions from the counties that are being served. And I guess I'm wondering, too, have you given any thought at all to surveying the counties that you don't audit to find out if there are some issues there that you would like to audit more counties, that you've made that very clear to us along the way. Wouldn't it make sense to find out from the counties that are not using your office as to what it would take for them to consider doing it?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't know that I've expressed a desire to take on additional counties. Statute allows the office to decide, you know, with our staffing levels and everything else, the audits we'll be conducting. And there's a review every 3 years in terms of entities we will or won't audit. And because it was set up as, you know, kind of on a rotational basis. In terms of surveying counties that aren't currently audited by us, I guess one of my issues is I don't have enough staff to do this. I got cut by almost $1 million last session, which has made it harder for us to get our work done, not necessarily in the audit division, but in some of our other divisions. And so I only have so much staff to do the work, and if you would be able to provide me with additional staff, I could do additional work. But we have to get out of our statutory reports and do all the functions we're required to do at this time. We do, the staff, understand, I have people in there that are highly professional, and we work with these counties, we monitor the counties, we review the audits. It's something that I'm charged with overseeing and making sure is done well, and we work hard to do that. So I don't know that an additional survey would be needed. In terms of the survey, you know, it's like it's yes/no questions. Are you? You know, what's your name? What's your address? And who should we contact if we have questions? Was the first question. The second question was, you know, are you a GFOA audit or not? If they were a GFOA audit, it was your deadline? Was your audit completed by June 30? And then it was yes or no. For the non-GFOAs, it was your audit completed by September 30? Yes or no. So, and I can get you a copy, but this pretty much explains everything that was on there. Was it, you know, did your cost increase or decrease? So you either checked increase or decrease. And then if there was an increase, they were given a list of options, which are all on the next page. And if it decreased, there was a list, which is on the next page with all the, you know, options for them. And then, you know, do you want us to contact you? Was a yes or no? So I'm not, I can get that to you, but that's what the survey is. It's pretty much here. And we can get you a copy of the survey. In terms of an adequate survey, statute requested that we conduct a survey of counties. That was the language on, you know, timeliness, cost, and quality. And so we did that. Some of the items in the increase-decrease actually come out of academic papers, and there's an accounting magazine we use for things that have been established in terms of what impacts an audit. Timeliness and cost. So we can't hire a survey firm. We don't have the funds for it. We're just trying to get our work done at this point. So we don't have the resources that maybe some other folks have.
Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. State Auditor Otto, as you recall, last year we had some discussions about allowing more counties to use private auditors for their services. I was wondering, in the past year, have you had any additional counties come forward to you and ask to do that?
Auditor Otto?
Mr. Chair, there's a staff member in my office who, if letters come in, I don't get all the correspondence. but there's a process for them, and they can submit letters. And so I'm not on top of that at the moment because that's up to my staff to determine how all that works. But there is a process where they can request either to come back to us, as you know, because they want us to audit their entity again, or request to be released. But there's a process in place that's been working since Auditor Anderson was in there. So,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Murray.
Auditor Otto, so you're not aware of any counties that have asked either to come back in or asked to go out on their private, to use a private auditor. Are you aware of any that you have allowed to do that over the past year?
Auditor Otto?
Mr. Chair, normally it's a three-year cycle, so we don't do it on an annual basis. It wouldn't make sense for these communities that are hiring a private firm to have to change every year. There's great inefficiencies that occur with that and greater costs, so it's not good for the entity. So typically you let them go out for 3 years for a three-year contract, and then after that three-year period, it all gets reviewed.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative,
could you explain just briefly your three-year cycle and how that works then?
Auditor Otto?
Mr. Chair, once every 3 years, entities, before their contracts expire, can communicate with us whether they want to come back, if they want to stay, or if they'd like to get a private bid. That's how it works. And then the staff communicates with those counties, and then people proceed, you know, as they would. So,
thank you.
That answers your question. Mm-hmm.
Representative Benson.
Auditor Otto. In the statute I have in front of me, it says that satisfaction with timeliness, quality, and cost of auditor's work, and so on. And you've provided us some information relative to some of those. But what I don't get from that is most satisfaction surveys have, standards by which it's, you know, excellent, very good, you know, good, fair, marginal. I don't see anything written into the survey results, at least that we have. We don't have the survey yet in front of us that would allow for the entities to actually rate you, so to speak, or your office in a way that would give you some meaningful, you're doing a great job, you're not doing such a great job. And I guess that was the question I was asking before. Who formulated the survey? How did you arrive at the questions that were asked? And had you ever even given some thought at possibly using an outside firm to come up with one? You know, surveys are one of those things where an instrument can get you pretty much what you're looking for if you're not careful. You know, it has to be statistically so and arranged in a way so that you get a fair answer to the question. Mm-hmm. And then, you are going to be ultimately someone who's going to go back and audit them again. And I'm wondering, especially when it comes to qualities like that, is there any thought of having this as a blind survey so that people could honestly rate you in a way that you wouldn't know it was Olmsted or Goodhue or something like that? Just speaking to the statute says satisfaction with timeliness, and I don't see any gauges of that.
Auditor Otto?
Mr. Chair, the nature of auditing is pretty technical, and this survey is fact-driven and data-driven because that's audits are fact-based and data-based. You're looking at information, you're running particular tests, and the issues are, was your audit timely or not? The majority of them are. Did your cost increase, decrease? We had quite a few that decreased. There were some that increased. And then you look at what are the reasons. What I think this really does is it can be somewhat educational if you look at it, because it really does. This is what I've been teaching the county commissioners. Some of these issues are in academic papers. There are things that are known to increase audit costs or decrease, you know, whether you like it or not. Do people like paying for an audit? Probably almost not many people really like paying for it, especially county commissioners who are dealing with budget struggles. All local governments have asked our office, is there anything we can do differently because audits are so expensive? Towns, I mean, a lot of them we don't even audit. And that's the nature of the beast right now, and it does take resources. But in terms of satisfaction, I would think that most of these entities would be very happy that they've got a timely audit and the costs have decreased. But no, you know, we don't have the money to have a national firm come in. But what I can tell you is this stuff happens every day with my staff and these entities. And I get emails from these entities saying your staff does an excellent job. We're very pleased with your services. I got a folder this thick. So I save them. They let us know when they're satisfied. And some have gone out private and asked to come back. So it's interesting. But we conduct this work every day, and I'm concerned every day about how counties are doing. And if a county commissioner has an issue, I've called them and said, you know, how can we help you? So I don't know what else we would do. We have work to conduct for the taxpayers, and we're there for the people's best interests. So that's what we do.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Chairman. I just do want to get to this because I don't think that it's the duty of the legislature to get into the minutiae of how, you know, agencies are ran. But for this at least, I'm wondering, do we have to put it in statute, you know, specifically what we're requesting in order to make sure that an adequate survey about how the people that, I mean, this is a big deal. You know, there are a number of counties in the state that are relying upon your audits. And I think it's for a meaningful survey, there needs to be some kind of customer satisfaction index that is reported. I guess what I've heard from you is that you're satisfied with the results in the makeup of the current audit, and you're not willing to at least look at what the statute really reads in terms of a satisfaction index.
Auditor Otto.
Representative Lanning. I'm not an agency. The office is not an agency. We're not. It's a very different beast. We're an independent constitutional office. The reason why I'm elected is because if the people aren't happy with what I'm doing, they can unelect me. That's the power of the people. The people ask me back, and I'm not trying to lecture you to be disrespectful, but this is my job. And I would never critique your work as legislators or the session or whatever else. Things sometimes happen. That was a joke, Representative Benson. I know, it wasn't that funny. But anyway... you do the jobs the best that you can, representing your people the best that you can, and you feel you're doing the best work that you can. I do the best that I can for the people that elected me to oversee $20 billion taxpayer money every year. And I didn't recommend a survey be conducted to the public about last session. It wouldn't be my role. It would be inappropriate for me to do. Now, the State Auditor's Office audits a lot of state money. So there's a great state interest in how this money is being handled. Is it being handled properly? And so that's why this office is here, because the state has a great interest. The system's not broken. It's working really well. And so I don't know why there's continued focus on our audits and the county satisfaction. And I think some of the counties are wondering why all this is happening, frankly, and some of them have asked me anonymously what's going on, because this normally is not an area of great political attention, because things go very, very well. So Representative Benson, it sounds like you're frustrated, but this is an excellent survey, and I had counties thank me for the survey. They were like, great, glad you asked. But this isn't like buying a hamburger. It's very different. It's an audit. And they're kind of non-sexy, but they're very important to make sure there's accountability with taxpayer money and a lot of state money.
Representative Benson, and then we need to move on, folks.
Okay. Sure.
Well, just a comment. This is actually something that the governor asked for at the conference committee.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I got the answer that I expected, so I don't have any further comment. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair? May I ask one more thing, or tell you one more thing?
Yes.
Thank you. I'll be very brief. I did present this to the governor on January 11th. He was the state auditor, and he was absolutely delighted by the results, and he said, this is fantastic. When he was in the office, it was a lot tougher, and there were some issues. When I got there, there were quite a few issues that I had to deal with timeliness and cost. We are in a really good place. The staff is in a good place. The counties are in a pretty good place. And so he was very pleased, and I'm pleased as well. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. We will move on with the agenda. The next item is House File 1903, Representative Erdahl. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to give an impassioned, vigorous presentation today in the hopes that hot air could warm up the room a little bit.
It probably could use it here.
I'll just resort to my my normal technique on this. Do we need a motion first?
Yes.
Yes. You want to make your motion?
I move that the 1903 pass and be referred to the floor.
General Register?
General Register?
Yes.
Okay, that's my motion.
That's his motion. All right, you may proceed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill concerns Honor Guard burial details not receiving timely stipends of $50 for burials. Payments have been delayed. They're partial or possibly denied because of possible connections with a post that has charitable gambling. I believe this is wrong. This honors veterans who have served their country and in some cases died for their country, and payments should be made promptly. We should show proper support and respect for our heroes and not punish those providing charities with funding while the charitable gambling funding declines in our state. So I welcome any questions but urge your support.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, when I read this language, I hardly see why it causes any kind of delays. Certainly seems like it's the most permissive thing I've ever seen. Seems the commissioner may give priority. It doesn't require them to give priority. It seemed to be pretty easy for them to have a list of the ones that might have support from, you know, they could have some process where places that don't have support from gambling operations came forward and said that they didn't, and they had that list, and I don't understand why it should cause more than 10 minutes worth of delay, the language as it is. And the idea that they wouldn't be able to make this decision is a little troubling to me because I don't see what the problem is with them being able to make it.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kahn. Your analysis may be correct, but in practicality, that's not how it works.
Well,
it takes months, and some get delayed or don't even get the payment. In Litchfield, the example that I'm most familiar with, because this came from Litchfield, the post there, organizations that receive charitable gambling funds would be reimbursed on August 15th, provided that funds were available. The letter was dated December 14th. They listed 8 funerals that had been submitted, and they didn't receive funding until a couple of months after that.
Well,
so they're getting the funding in practicality months after they submit, if they get the funding at all.
Well, I don't...
Representative Kahn.
And they specifically stated that the how many units submitted requests for funding in that period of time?
Well, statewide, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Statewide, I don't know how many. I know, again, my one post, what they did in this, but this is a statewide situation. I have with me the commander's. Minnesota Commanders Task Force legislative platform for this year, and one of their legislative requests is this particular issue.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Chairman, I would imagine that probably most of them are supported by gambling, and so I can understand why they'd want to take any impediment out of the way. But I don't, I still don't understand why this is a problem, why they can't initiate a process, you know, that the request has to be made the request has to be made in a very short period of time. They have to maintain a list of units who would be eligible for priority. If a request comes in and that unit doesn't have a request in instantly, then you know, then there's no delay. I just, this really seems like a very, you know, I mean, there are lots of people in the state who say that they're opposed to encouragement of gambling. This certainly seems like a very benign line in state statutes that gives some help to someone who has decided that somehow they don't want to do charitable gambling. And I really just can't see how we would vote for this.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Representative Bland. Representative Kahn, once again, it's what you're saying isn't necessarily wrong, but the fact is
it's actually
that,
right.
But the fact is that that's not how it's working. It does. There are delays, and that shouldn't be the case. And charitable gambling in Minnesota is declining, and many of our posts don't have money. And the fact, again, is we have not cut this program. Money appropriations to the Veterans Department has actually increased, so we don't understand why there are these delays or why money is being withheld.
Well, first of all, Mr. Chairman, and maybe counsel can help me, because I think it's one of the concrete accomplishments I actually had in the legislature, is that I don't think we have a term in statute that refers to charitable gambling anymore. I think we've changed it all to loft, but, you know, I obviously missed one if this is here. And maybe counsel, I thought that the basic operation is now referred to as lawful gambling. Because one of the things we discovered was how little was charitable about it. But just the question, counsel, if he knows that, or question to the chair or any member if they know that.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, I believe you're correct that in most of the regulatory statutes it is referred to as lawful.
And so, Mr. Shepard, in fact, the existing language is not really consistent with the rest of statute in terms of referring to it as charitable gambling when that is not an official.
Mr. Chair and members, that this statute may have pre-existed the changes in the other laws governing gaming, lawful gaming, and I don't think the use of this term in this statute has any legal impact.
Well, the suggestion I would make to fix your bill would be to restore the stricken language and replace the word charitable with lawful, so you will have done something.
Representative Erdahl is not going to do that amendment, I take it.
And Mr. Chairman, no, I think we'll just leave it the way it is. There is a problem. Payments are being delayed, and this fixes it.
Further discussion.
Mr. Chairman, I disagree with the statement that if there is a problem and payments are being delayed, that this will fix it. I really doubt that this is a cause of the delay in payments. But I don't believe in messing around with friends' bills, so I'll wait to make that amendment at some later time.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, last night when I read this, I thought of two experiences that I've had in the last 2 months. And I just want the answer. And I'm not trying to be smart-mouthed or anything. At one of the funerals, the person that played taps was not a student, but was like perhaps 50 or 60 years old. At the other funeral that I attended, somebody just played a recording of taps. And I was wondering when I read this, then, would those two people get paid?
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Lanning. I'm not sure. It says the law says student. This is, you know, the words you're referring to are current law.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I'd check into. I don't know. It says
the word is student. I don't know if anyone else has knowledge about that.
And the other is the other instance was a person was at the place wasn't playing. It just stuck a disc in.
Representative Lanning, Representative Murphy, I don't think that they pay $50 for a recording.
If further discussion.
How differently? Let me know.
Further discussion. You want to renew your motion?
Yes, I renew my motion that this bill—I forget my number—pass and be referred to the General Register.
To the what?
You're moving House File 1903.
Doesn't have to go to Ways and Means.
No.
Okay. No. We understand it can go to the floor. So the motion is to recommend House File 1903 to pass and be sent to the General Register. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. The bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, members.
The next item is House File 1560, Representative Wardlow. Welcome, Representative Wardlow, and I will move that House File 1560 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 1560 is a significant, or at least an important, regulatory reform that will create a uniform process for hearing contested cases in administrative disputes between state agencies and regulated parties in the Office of Administrative Hearings. This bill obliges referral of all contested cases to the Office of Administrative Hearings, whereas right now, in certain instances, cases may be heard and determined by the agencies themselves. And it also confers upon the administrative law judges of the Office of Administrative Hearings final decision-making authority in all cases. Presently, they have final decision-making authority in a smattering of subject matter areas and only recommended decision-making authority in other areas, allowing agencies to rewrite the findings of the administrative law judges after a hearing and trial in the Office of Administrative Hearings, which I think is improper. This bill increases public confidence in the system by making sure that if there is an appeal of a decision of an administrative law judge, they will go to the Court of Appeals along with the agency on equal footing. There will be no rewriting of the findings of fact, and it will lead to better results. So, with that, take questions.
Questions for the author? Representative Meline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Wardlow. Can you just tell me right now, if you know offhand, how many agencies would be affected by this legislation? How many agencies currently have the authority to review the decisions?
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Representative Meline. Mr. Chair, I believe, let's see, final decision-making authority is granted to the Office of Administrative Hearings in a number of areas. Perhaps actually a member from the Office of Administrative Hearings would help out better with this question.
Judge Lippman? Please identify yourself for the record. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Eric Lippman. I'm the Assistant Chief Administrative Law Judge for the Minnesota Office of Administrative Hearings. Mr. Chairman, Representative Meline, I believe the answer to your question is all the agencies in the smattering that Representative Wardlow described. There are certain carve-outs where the Office of Administrative Hearings has final decision-making authority. And generally, the Office of Administrative Hearings takes referrals of contested cases, which is a term of art but is described in your House summary in the first paragraph of the House summary. And we serve all of the state agencies and roughly 100 local units of government to resolve disputes that they may well have. And so our client roster, as we refer to it, is all the major departments that you would know and boards and commissions here in state agencies and also, like I say, roughly 100 or so local units of government that we also do work for.
Representative Maylene.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Judge Lippman, since I have you there, I have a question for you. Currently, do you know offhand out of the agencies either carved out in the amendment or that would be affected in Representative Wardlow's bill, how often is it that the agency comes to a different decision than the administrative law judge came to?
Judge Lippman.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Maylene, I'm not sure we have statistics about how often the findings of an administrative law judge are changed or altered on review by the final decision maker at the agency. I would suggest to you it's a common event. You know, everything from a date is changed to the entire holding of the case, and there's been a practice of not infrequent revision. I think that would be the best way to describe it.
Okay. Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge Lippman, I have a question for you, or actually for the author. It seems that this bill is trying to solve some kind of problem. And so what are the problems? Why is this bill coming forward? You know, we're hearing concerns from the agencies that potentially, you know, they've had the final decision-making power, and it's turning it back to the judge. As we know, from everything we hear in this committee, it's really complicated, the work that the agencies do. So what do you think it's trying to address, and do you think they're being decided incorrectly right now?
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Representative Slavik. Mr. Chair, I would say what this bill is trying to address, I don't know the extent to which cases are being decided incorrectly by agencies or findings that they're rewriting are being done incorrectly. But the fact of the matter is it's not appropriate, just from a principal point of view, to have an agency and oftentimes be the policymaker and the body that is implementing the policy and then the prosecutor in a case, a contested case, and then have the ability to rewrite findings after an administrative hearing has already been held and then go to the Court of Appeals with their revised findings, only needing to show a scintilla of evidence that to support their revised findings, as opposed to the regulated party that's contesting the findings at the Court of Appeals. So it's just a matter of fairness, and it's a matter of separation of powers, really, even though it's all within, we're talking about within one branch, the executive branch of government. But the executive branch of government has grown so large that it now functions in many ways like in legislative ways, quasi-legislative ways, and quasi-judicial ways, and we put all those things together, that's just, from a principle standpoint, not a good idea.
Representative Slawick.
Mr. Chair, and of course, I'm not a lawyer, so this is kind of out of my normal realm of knowledge. What do other states do? Other states have this kind of a process, or are we bringing it in line more with other states by doing what you're doing, or what else is happening out there?
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you. I'm not certain exactly how other states handle this, but I know that the way we handle it here is not quite right. And from a principal's point of view, this fixes that and will increase public confidence in the system, because you won't have agencies creating policy on the backs of litigants in contested cases. Now, the reason agencies often give why will they oppose this kind of reform and why they think the ALJ should only have recommended decision-making authority is that they have the expertise and they have the ability to see the larger policy perspective. But while that may be true, they should not be rewriting their policies in contested cases. This isn't some kind of administrative common law that they should be developing through contested cases. Rather, they should be using the rulemaking process and other processes to create or implement statutes and create their internal agency policies. And then the contested case procedure should be used to determine whether a litigant has been treated fairly or if a rule has been applied to a litigant in a proper manner.
Representative Wardlow, I think Judge Lippman has an answer or response to the question Representative Slawick raised.
That was wonderful.
Mr. Chairman, members, and Representative Slawik, I think it's a broad range. Everything from all decisions are recommended to the other end of the spectrum, and I think that that's something that's been happening more recently, is that larger chunks of decision-making authorities have been referred to panels like ours. It's called a central panel concept, which is an independent decision-maker, and our tribunal is within the executive branch, that would render either recommended or final decisions. At one end of the spectrum, most recently, is Louisiana, where they have final decision-making authority, much along the lines of Representative Wardlow's bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Slawik.
Just a comment is, you know, we had the Pawlenty administration for 8 years, and this bill, was this bill ever brought up during that time? I mean, now all of a sudden it's the Dayton administration, and bringing it up, has this bill been brought up in the past, or is this the first time?
Representative Wardlow?
Thank you. I'm not aware. I don't know. Do you have a better?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slawik, I think that the approach was to give us, there have been recent bills of assigning final decision-making authority in pieces. I think that there were some in the Pawlenty administration and prior to that, where I think the trend has been to give discrete assignments, that list of the places where we have final decision-making authority, special education cases, OSHA cases, human rights and discrimination cases, the campaign cases, would be examples of the roughly dozen different areas where we have final decision-making authority. And I think that the legislature's judgment in recent years has been to assign distinct categories. I think Representative Wardlow's bill makes another policy shift, which is we're sending it all.
Representative Wardlow, do you have people to testify on behalf of your bill?
Nope.
Okay. Representative Meline, and then we do have some people who wanted to testify on the bill. So, Representative Meline.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, maybe I could wait for the other testifiers, but I did have another question for Judge Littman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative.
Thank you. Judge Littman, when you say that you have final decision-making authority, you said that several times. Aren't your decisions still subject to appellate review?
Indeed. Mr. Chairman, Representative Mellon, yes, indeed.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Winkler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is also for Judge Littman. And it follows up on Representative Mellon's question. We talked in the Government Operations Committee about the standard of review at the Court of Appeals, and I wonder if you could just give us a quick overview of how the Court of Appeals reviews your final decisions or the final agency decisions, and whether you have an opinion about that standard of review.
Judge Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, the second question first, which is, I don't have an opinion. We'll leave that to the good judgment. By policy, the OAH doesn't take policy positions on legislation or changes. To maintain our independence, we're here as a resource. Are delighted to answer questions both in the hearing setting and with members, but don't take a policy position about the particular standard of review. The standard of review is that the agency's decision must be supported by, as I think Representative Wardlow suggested, a scintilla of evidence in the record. And so whether we're the final, whether we stand in the shoes of the executive branch agency or the executive branch agency, the agency head renders that decision themselves, the Court of Appeals will take that quote-unquote agency decision and review that about whether it's a scintilla of evidence in the record in support of that, whatever that decision is.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Judge Littman, I'm looking at the statute on the Administrative Procedure Act, and the phrase scintilla, or the word scintilla, doesn't appear. They talk about arbitrary or capricious,
yeah,
and substantial evidence. So I wonder if you could, you know, I don't know that all of us are experts on the word scintilla, and if you could just give kind of a common sense or practical explanation of what that means, because it's not in the statute either.
Right.
Judge Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, and members.
Of what that means, because it's not in the statute either.
Right.
Judge Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, and members, whether there is support for the decision in the hearing record. And so whether it's a decision is arbitrary or capricious, if it if the agency, the decision maker relies upon factors which are not in the statute, which are not in the record, are examples of whim or caprice, that it isn't well grounded in the record and of documents and testimony in the particular case. And so what Representative Wardlow was describing is not a standard where it's more likely than not that the decision was correct. It is a standard of, is there reasonable support for that decision in the record?
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, Judge Lippman, I know this is not a civil law committee, but we started this conversation in the last committee, and I'm trying to understand it, because you said scintilla, which I would, think, if there's a grain of sand on the scale that supports it, the agency wins. But then you said reasonable evidence, and the statute says substantial evidence or arbitrary and capricious. So does the Court of Appeals choose which standard they use, or is this something that's just evolved over time, that the court always uses the grain of sand approach, or how does that work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, again, the scintilla of evidence was a quotation from a particular case, and I can give you the citation. Is it? Oh, yes, I'm sorry. In the matter of the revocation of the family child care license of Linda Beckman, and it's a Court of Appeals decision, where that standard is described about whether there is a scintilla of evidence in support of the license revocation. That was an appeal from a daycare licensing case, which is the kinds of matters that are referred to our office.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Judge Lippman, but I want to understand, is that always the standard that the Court of Appeals uses, or is that the standard the Court of Appeals has used? Because the statute lays out six different grounds that the court could overturn the agency decision. So how often is the scintilla of evidence the standard that the court uses?
Judge Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, I'll have to look. But I'll get you back something. I admit that I'm not as focused on at least the statistics about reversals. And frankly, I think happily, the range of reversals is, at least from our office, is fairly modest.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Judge Lippman, or Representative Wardlaw, I'm not looking for stats. I guess the representation in this committee and the last one is that the standard of review is a scintilla of evidence. And what I'm hearing is the standard of review that the court could use is arbitrary and capricious, or a scintilla of evidence, or a grain of sand. But that isn't the standard that they always use. And it seems to me that the court can decide what the appropriate standard of review should be in any particular case. So it's not as though the law is kind of rigged on behalf of agencies when it comes to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals can use its discretion.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, I'll try to take a run at this one more time. As I understand it, the court is putting flesh to the bones of what it means to be arbitrary or capricious in a particular case. The standard under, or the description, as you're reading from Chapter 14, is whether the agency acted arbitrarily and capriciously. And so I think that they look to whether there is support in the hearing record for that decision to determine whether it's arbitrary or capricious. And at least in the Beckman case, they suggested that if there was a scintilla of evidence, that was good enough to show that the agency had not acted arbitrarily with respect to that particular daycare license.
One could think of other reasons why a court might
Representative
find
Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Might find a decision arbitrary or capricious. As Judge Lippman was saying, there could be evidence of bad faith, ulterior motive, looking at things that are entirely beyond the record. But provided that I think none of those very egregious kinds of facts exist for a court to look at and declare, well, hey, this is an inappropriate decision because it's arbitrary, capricious, unreasonable, provided that doesn't exist, if they're just looking at the record, all they need is a scintilla of evidence, a grain of sand, to support. And I think in the Beckman case, it was rewritten findings.
Well,
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to make the final point to the committee that it is not true that the system is so rigged on behalf of the agencies that their opinion governs and the court can't do anything about it unless there's some very extreme situation. The statute says that the court can reverse the decision of the agency if it violates the Constitution, if it goes beyond the statutory authority of the agency, if they use an unlawful procedure, if they made a mistake of law, if it was unsupported by substantial evidence. So in other words, that's not no evidence, that's substantial evidence, that's more, or if it's arbitrary and capricious. So there's lots of reasons the court can have for overturning an agency decision. And as we consider this bill, I just think it's very important that we not assume that the individual or the business or whoever it is dealing with the agency has no recourse at the Court of Appeals, because by long-standing use of the Administrative Procedures Act, the courts step in to make sure the agencies are following the law and are acting based on the record. And so I just think there's been kind of a misperception about how much deference or how much power the agency has to make a final decision under current law. And I guess I question whether making this substantial change is really aiding any of the goals that we would hope to aid as far as a fair review and a fair process and fair application of the rules.
You wish to respond? We need to get to the testimony here, too. Okay. Thank you, Judge Lipman. For newer members, you may not be aware of the fact that Judge Lipman was a member of the House here a number of years ago. And we have some people who have requested an opportunity to testify in this bill. First of all, Assistant Commissioner Michelle Beeman.
PCA.
From MPCA. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Michelle Beeman. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. My area is in legal and enforcement policy. And I am here just, again, to give the perspective of the agencies. A number of the points have been brought out already, and I appreciate the dialogue that you've had and the questions you've had. As the second committee, I've also had a chance to talk with the author, and there have been some changes already to the bill, which we think are moving in the right direction. But I just wanted to speak on behalf only of the PCA, although there are some other agencies I know that have similar concerns, describing how we work in this situation in terms of our contested cases and our dealings with the Office of Administrative Hearings. For those who aren't as familiar and steeped in the Administrative Procedure Act as executive agencies are, just let me remind you that the APA has been in place for a very long time to structure how the process works for administrative agencies to make decisions and to allow due process for those that we regulate. The APA presumes that executive agencies are there to implement and enforce the laws set out by this body. So a large part, particularly for example the PCA, we are out to make sure that the pollution laws are both implemented through permits but then also are complied with, and when there's violations we take enforcement actions. That's the role of that agency. In those enforcement actions, there's clearly due process for the regulated party to challenge decisions and the findings and the facts under which we're taking action. The Administrative Procedure Act sets up how those contested cases, as they're known, can take place. But they only come at the end of a long process already where there's a lot of information exchanged with the parties. The way it's structured is administrative law judges, as part of the executive branch, they are not regular courts. They are not part of the judicial branch. They are there to help with the fact-finding and to help with the record development, so that it's not simply the agency alone is the only place that a contested party can interact. ALJs are used much like you might be familiar with a special master or a magistrate in the court setting to hold an independent hearing, to allow the regulated party to bring in witness or bring in evidence and to have a fuller discussion and develop that record. But for decades now, it has always been presumed that the recommendation from the ALJ comes back to the agency, and that's for a reason. It allows the agency, as the one who's making those final decisions, the benefit of this additional record, the benefit of seeing what additional information was presented, and it may change the commissioner or the agency's mind before a final decision is then issued. And what I could say is we haven't done an exhaustive audit of all of ours. We don't have that many contested cases that go all the way through in a year. For the PCA, maybe it's four or five a year that make it to an actual contested case hearing. In the vast majority of cases, the recommendation that comes back is what's adopted and is what agreed to. I do question where the problem is exactly, and it may be with a different subject area, maybe a different agency. We don't see, in our agency, significant, we don't do significant rewritings of decisions. In fact, as I say, most of the time we're in agreement with the ALJ. But an important situation to remember is that ALJs are generalists, as most judges are generalists. They see lots of matters that come before them. We are an agency that has a lot of technical information. When we have a violation, it can be about a permit that has a lot of very technical aspects. And we place a great deal of time and thought into how we bring enforcement actions if we need to, how we set penalties. And so sometimes what we've had is a situation where an ALJ has made a recommendation on with the final outcome where there's a set of findings. Well, we have agreed with the outcome. We actually agree with the outcome, but the way that the judge laid things out in a finding, it didn't quite mesh up to the federal or the regulation we have. And we've made some adjustment to the finding so that the record was clear, and so we weren't at risk of being viewed, if it were to go up to the Court of Appeals, as arbitrary because there was something skewed. Sometimes ALJs don't quite get it right. Sometimes the agency doesn't get it right or reconsiders it. In fact, our most recent decision, where the recommendation that came out from the ALJ, they recommended we lower the penalty from what we had initially set. And we ultimately agreed with that. We thought that there was additional information that warranted the lowering of the penalty. However, the reason that the ALJ had given for that, lowering the penalty, didn't quite fit the facts as we understood them. We thought there was some different information that the ALJ had identified in the hearing that actually warranted the reduction in penalty. So we get those situations sometimes. We ended up, the regulated party got a reduced penalty, didn't go up to the Court of Appeals, but we had a cleaner record and we had additional facts upon which to make that decision. That, we believe, is how exactly that balance of information and power works. The Court of Appeals, sitting in the judicial branch, then is that ultimate authority where either party can bring their challenge. I think it should be very thoughtful. We don't want to turn ALJs into district court judges. If they have a final decision and it goes to the Court of Appeals, there really isn't a whole lot of difference between sending things directly to district court then. There is a benefit to allowing the executive branch to complete that decision-making authority, and we just think that there's really no reason to really mess with the dynamic here. If there are some discrete areas, which it as has been testified to, in the past the law has been changed to allow certain discrete subject areas to go to ALJs for final decisions, debate that. But I think a wholesale change of the Administrative Procedure Act and how agencies use ALJs and the Office of Administrative Hearings is just not warranted at this point and doesn't help in all of us making clear decisions that are defensible on the written record. And as Representative Winkler has pointed out, the standard we take very seriously, that we are not making arbitrary and capricious decisions, and we think we can defend that our decisions have been very solid. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. We have one more testifier, and then we'll give Representative Wardlaw a chance to respond. Karen Mickelson from DHS.
Hi.
Welcome, and please identify yourself for the record.
I'm Karen Mickelson. I'm with the Department of Human Services, and thank you for letting us speak a quick minute. We have some concerns about the bill, and I've got Diane Kruger here, who's our Director of Appeals and Regulations in the department. She's going to give a brief overview of some of the comments about how it affects our agency and what we do. And I also would like to comment that the amendment, I would need to have our licensing division take a greater look at that. That could affect quite a bit of the work that's done in our licensing division. So I'd like to look at that too. Diane?
Mr. Chair, thank you, and members of the committee. Thank you for giving us an opportunity to speak.
And please say your name for the record, too.
My name is Diane Kruger. I am the Director of the Appeals and Regulations Division for the Department of Human Services. I think, actually, Assistant Commissioner Beeman did an excellent job of articulating most of our concerns. We at the agency, at the Department of Human Services, do issue a number of decisions in contested case hearings, primarily in the licensing area. We probably have in excess of 60 decisions issued each year. And it is And the vast majority of those, I would say that we would adopt the recommendation, the recommended decision of the Office of Administrative Hearings. We may add a memorandum. We may alter some of the findings in response to exceptions that we receive from either one of the parties. But I would say the vast majority of the time we accept their recommendations. Our concerns relate simply to the fact that we think, as the agency with the responsibility to enforce the laws, we do have unique expertise in this area. And as an agency decision maker, we can ensure that there's consistency. With a general panel, there might not be consistency in decisions. It's true that Minnesota courts have afforded us some level of deference, but I can say, having signed a number of decisions that have in fact been overturned in the Court of Appeals, they do not just rubber stamp our decisions. So those are our concerns. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? If not, Representative Wardlow, do you want to, whatever response you want to give?
Yes, very briefly, thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to due process, perhaps it would be helpful just to talk about that concept. That's what's driving this, the constitutional requirement for procedural due process, which consists of two things. Anybody in any regulated party must be given notice and an opportunity to be heard. So notice that a rule is being imposed or that, you know, there's going to be an administrative penalty, whatever it is, notice, and then an opportunity to go to the agency or to be heard in some fashion that's meaningful. So when we have an outcome of a contested case hearing for an independent body within the executive branch, the Office of Administrative Hearings, and when that can be rewritten by the agency after the decision has already been rendered, after a trial, how meaningful is the opportunity of the regulated party to be heard? The scintilla of evidence standard comes in when an agency takes the decision of an ALJ and rewrites it. The rewritten findings need only be supported by a scintilla of evidence, a grain of sand, something in the record, and that's it. So the agency gets a second bite of the apple. So we're really undermining meaningful procedural due process if we allow agencies to create policy on the backs of litigants and get a second bite at the apple before they go to the Court of Appeals, if that's where the case is headed.
So
this bill helps preserve meaningful due process for regulated parties, and I'll just leave it at that.
Representative Gunther?
Basically, the author just said what I was going to say. If a department can make rules to change the outcome of a dispute, as well as act as a, in that way they're acting as the legislature, making rules or laws changing the way that we operate, and then they can sit there at a completely unfair advantage in a dispute. I'd like to use the example of Representative Winkler. He represents a nursing home. All of a sudden, the Department of Human Services changes a rule, or makes a rule to make the outcome go towards the department's way. His client, that nursing home, will not prevail against somebody that can make rules in making the dispute go the way that the department wants them to go. So I think it's unfair if we don't have some independent party, such as the ALJ, coming and interceding in Representative Winkler's client's behalf. Otherwise, he could never win.
No, it's fine.
Representative Murphy?
It's more difficult.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wardlow, what do you mean by after it's the trial?
Representative Wardlow?
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Chair, the hearing before the administrative law judge of the contested case. That's what I was referring to. It's a full hearing.
That's just
and their, you know, witnesses can testify, and so.
Are there lawyers?
There could be lawyers, yes.
But there's not always.
Representative Murphy.
Right. Mr. Chair. Are there always lawyers?
No. Representative Wardlow.
Perhaps Judge Littman might shed light on the procedures contested cases at the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Judge Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, in about 25% of the OAH cases are parties representing themselves. So we have pro se litigants and people who come in and act as their own attorney in about 25% of our cases. A matter that we point to with pride. It shows us to be an open and accessible tribunal. But in most of the matters that go to a hearing, I think that there are attorneys.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Judge Littman. It's more folksy than any trial, though, isn't it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, I think we do have rules of procedure, and it probably looks more like law and order than a city council meeting if we were put it on a spectrum. It does look like a trial, but we do try to be open and accessible and have simple and clear rules of procedure so that any person of some education could represent themselves, that they don't need a lawyer. That's again something that we strive to do, to be open and accessible, because not all people with a dispute with a state agency have the wherewithal to retain an attorney.
Mr. Chair.
Or did you have something further, Representative Murphy?
Yeah, my concept of a hearing before a judge like Judge Littman is that it's more of a give and take and coming to understanding, and that presents more time to the people that are coming. So I don't see what Representative Wardlow was saying is that they're totally rewritten. I always thought it was more of coming to consensus. I haven't had a whole lot of experience at the administrative law hearings, but I've had a couple, and at both of them, I thought we were coming, the agency and the persons that were before them were coming to more of an understanding and agreement on what should be done. And so totally rewriting and all that stuff, I don't think it's as clear as what you were saying. And I use the word folksy because I just observed a lot more give and take.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, just briefly, there are a number of bits of work that we do, not only in the contested type trial hearings that are described by Representative Wardlow, but we also have a very robust mediation services, which may well be what you're referring to. Our judges, many of whom are 114 neutrals, do try to get the parties to settle them their disputes as a matter of alternative dispute resolution. We also do rulemaking hearings, which are much more a legal review of administrative rules, which look more like a city council or a zoning commission type hearing than perhaps law and order.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Judge Littman, first of all, I'll say that I have in the long run been more supportive of putting more things in the hands of administrative law judges, because I think it adds to facilitating the actions of government. But I really have a problem with this one. For one thing, the description we've had of the rulemaking process is totally out of place. It is not just something that's done at the will of the agency. There's a whole process for not only contested rules, but a whole process for legislative review of rules, which I don't know if anyone on this committee has used, but I know I've used it to call for a legislative commission to look over a rule that I thought was inappropriate and actually got it not perfect, but slightly changed. So the idea, the other problem that I have, and I think this was adequately expressed by PCA and other agencies, and this is something that I've actually written articles about the necessity based on, and the basic philosophy is the innumeracy of the judicial branch, and this has been calling for better technological training of people who make judicial decisions. And so I think I can understand this in terms of kind of small decisions that might involve one person or, you know, a couple of small things, but the fact that there's no differentiation, this could be a really large decision that involved a major, you know, pollution issue or some kind of a human rights decision in the state. And I think that it would be totally inappropriate to, then I find it's kind of hard that the party who always complains about judicial activism is asking for more judicial activism in this, with this bill. So I think it's, you know, I think it could be useful in some cases, but not in the, with the broad scope that it's written here.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a question for Representative Wardlow.
Yes. Yeah. Are you concerned, for example, about the issue of the innumeracy of the judicial branch, for example?
Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn. I think that perhaps sometimes we trust too much in expertise, and I think that it is better, perhaps, to have consolidated hearings in one body where we know that they don't have an agenda.
You know.
And certainly a body that doesn't have an agenda that is lined up with the agency that has created the rule through a process, as you point out, through a complicated and sometimes Byzantine process. But certainly, it's not always best to put all of our faith in experts. Certainly, we don't do that in a democracy at the polls, and not everyone is an expert in all legal issues. We extend the right to vote to everybody. This is an example.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
No,
I'm just talking about things like the basic ability to count and compute and stuff like that. I'm not talking about expertise. I'm really talking about facts. You know, there are things that are just absolute facts that that can be presented. And it's not an opinion of experts. It's and I'm just talking about the inability of judges to sometimes judge those facts because they're beyond their level of expertise. And you don't think that ever happens? That's my question.
I think we have a
Representative Wardlaw, and then we're going to vote.
I think we have high-quality judges, both in the Office of Administrative Hearings and in our Article 6 courts.
Members, I will renew the motion that House File 1560 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All in favor of that signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. The bill is passed, and members, we still have a few things to work out for next Thursday's, or Wednesday's agenda, I should say, or Thursday, and we'll send something out to you as soon as that's finalized. Meeting adjourned.